Session number 1035, Rule 5.
Bishop Freddy Temple, Rule 5. Yes, we were talking, weren't we, about France and the areas you were in,
yes,
and the experience there. Did you leave before the victory parade?
Yes. Some people were starting to be released, and I had decided by then I wanted to be ordained, so I hoped to be able to be officially released in England, not only from the FAU, but from my tribunal sort of thing of serving, in order that I could start ordination training. So I came back, I think, in the spring of 45, was for a short period lodged in the Middlesex Hospital, where there was a unit, and worked just orderly as a back again as a hospital orderly, and then was released, and could start planning the future. And of course, one did qualify. Luckily, I mean, I think the amazing for the grant that War Service got for further training.
Do you think your experience in the war, you know, as a pacifist, particularly serving in the areas you did, and with the fighting forces, was that valuable for the work you were going to do in the ministry?
Oh, yes. Well, chiefly, I think, because it did get one on a really close relationship with ordinary folk, and realizing both their own greatnesses and goodnesses and goodness and one's own weaknesses as well, because I think, as Joan would say the same about her time in the war, that the danger for both of us would have been we could have grown up as tremendous snobs. Really, in my family was brought very well in that way. Worked on that way. I mean, I was brought up very much sort of, darling, you don't do that. That's the lower classes. I mean, is he or she top drawer? And you must be very careful. In fact, I was still horrified at this, really. The Duke of York's camp that King ran before the war, when I went with a friend from Rugby. It was all thought so marvellous, two public school boys and working class boys is all mixing, and we were all put separately with each other. My mother was terribly worried that I should catch fleas from these working class boys, and I had to promise, when I had sort of put down my sleeping bag and things there, that I made a little thing of Keating's powder all round my bed, which I proceeded to do, and then the lad next to me looked rather startled, but didn't say anything, and then I tried hesitatingly to. Later I thought, well, I'm start conversation with him, sort of said, and what are you reading? He looked me up and down and said, far too crude for you, mate. The war was excellent in that way. I mean, and still we both realised that some of our family, much as we love them, are still very much sort of upper class, and who are they, sort of thing. Even though nowadays, of course, people don't say this nearly as much, in that way. And I mean, at Rugby too, the townhouse, which was where boys who were only day boys belonged, and had some middle class and other upper class boys amongst it, as well as working class boys on grants. I mean, the rest of us all called them blogs, the blog house, and we were all fairly arrogant to dear old Teddy Heath, really, who became great friends because he was a music scholar, and so had one of the and fairly poor, and had one of the little rooms at the top in Balliol, and was from a grammar school. There, so it was a tremendous help in that way, I think.
Do you think the war generally sort of helped break down those attitudes, not just in your own case?
Oh, I think so, yes. I think a lot, yes. Because, yes, when I think of... and my mother, when I think of how horrified my mother was when she found that we had to take evacuees from London and what they would be like and how they would behave, and old things were put ready for them. But of course, it still goes on. Our daughter, when she went out to, I thought, I mean, and I was, how could mistaken I was, and when she wanted to go out as an au pair to France, she had a fortnight with one marvellous family that she managed to connect up her own. Then the Mergiers, the young Mergier who'd been one of the doctors in the unit, I said, oh, well, he'll be nice, I'm sure, and let's see. And they wanted an au pair. And she couldn't have been more frightfully treated by Mergier and his wife. I mean, they deliberately... She was allowed to eat with them, but when out shopping, they all deliberately got, always got, a worse cut of meat and cheaper cut of meat for her. And she had to scrub, the wife had a passion for cleanliness, she had to scrub the kitchen through every day. And one time, I forget, when they started talking English, spoke something in English, and so Mina answered in English, and one of the boys answered in French, "My, she speaks English with a good accent." And so it hasn't altogether stopped, certainly. But I'm sure it did break down a great deal.
Were you surprised when a Labour government came in at the end of the war, you know, was elected?
No, I think I was delighted there. I felt that, the time had come. And, of course, what was so good towards the end of the war, there, both in the forces and elsewhere, there were all these marvellous study courses provided by the government on what sort of Britain do people want and what should happen, so that though, again, my family, I mean, were absolutely horrified. And this sister was so horrified that her children were terrified. I mean, her oldest daughter, sort of coming up 10 or 11, I think, sort of said, "Will we all be put in prison?"
Shades of the Russian Revolution.
Yes, yes. Oh, yes. Completely. But... but an older sister of mine who's now died and was mayor and mayoress of Lewes several times, I remember talking about Lewes one time to her. She sort of, I said, and "Are you affected much by Sussex University having arrived in Brighton?" But she said, "Oh yes, we are quite a bit. Several of them now live in Lewes. But one doesn't see much of them because they're nearly all Labour." And then she said, oh, "Your daughter's Labour." Yes. I mean, most of our... it would be a great, incredible step if any of our generation of our families ever voted anything but true Conservative, I think.
What would you say the state of your pacifism was at the end of the war? You know, you've explained you had a few sort of lulls at times.
Yes.
But what, you know, would you say it was strengthened or weakened by the experience?
All through the war, all right, I think I say I was very shaken when the concentration camps were opened, I think, and I wonder about that. But I think I remained pacifist then until, as my uncle said, sort of we married and we had a child. And then the reports one got in those days from Greece and elsewhere of children being abducted to be taught communism and atheism. It was that, as I said, it was that side, I think, that made me realize I would resist that, I think. And so I always saw the point that it's right for people to, for many people to fight, and possibly, and I think, and so was probably not a pacifist for the time when children were dependent on me, but I think I've come back to it now again on this acutely individual point of view, not that sort of. Britain as a whole would be better or ought. I mean, I think I longed for United Nations to work better, and that is the one only thing that is to be said for the Gulf War, I think, that some form of collective security did function for once. Even though a point that I'd never realized till I heard it and saw it somewhere, that the states, Britain and France, in that order, vetoed more United Nations sanctions that should have against countries that should have taken place than ever the Soviet Union did. You hear so many people sort of saying, "Oh, it was it could work because the Cold War had finished." But the Soviet did far less blocking of United Nations action than either the States or Britain. By Britain usually then just following what the supporting the States in whatever they were doing. So I see a lot to be said for collective action. I don't know how, and if one could somehow make a United Nations peacekeeping force, not so bland as they usually seem to be. But I suppose maybe now when aircraft and other things can get there so quickly, they might be possible if it was known that sort of if a United Nations peacekeeping force was attacked, then others would rally in a more vigorous way. But on the other hand, I doubt whether there is such a thing as a just war now with the chaotic destruction. I mean, we were all relieved and you hear people saying, marvellous, the casualties were so few. But 80,000 to 100,000 Iraqi casualties, even when apparently an effort being made not to hit civilian targets.
And also the aftermath, you know.
I know. I'm supposed with quite what one will say and whether the young man will have it. A cleric near here says he's rang me the other day and said, I have a lot of army and diplomats living sort of round in my parish who are demanding a Thanksgiving service at the end of the Gulf War. And he said, I certainly don't want a Thanksgiving service for victory, but possibly some. Would you preach at it? But, I mean, one can't prepare it too much because one doesn't know what further mess there's going to be. It's interesting that, again, my Uncle William always, although supporting the war, said war never achieves anything. It only stops worse things happening. Which I think, when Churchill, after the fall of Singapore, when he was Archbishop of Canterbury, got in touch with him and said, "Please, can we have a National Day of Prayer and Penitence?" My uncle said, "No, I want to reserve that for after victory." And Churchill thought for a moment and said, "Yes, I understand that," and which is a, so if only. Mrs. Thatcher, whose great hero he was, had understood as much over the Falklands. And my uncle had died, of course, before victory came, but the service he would have had after victory, he said, people would have stood it, or St. Paul's, who would have had the would be to have had the choir coming in to a penitential psalm, and penitence first, because war is always the result of bad and theologically through a sinful diplomacy and actions beforehand. There.
Will you give that Thanksgiving service? Will you take part in it? Do you think?
Well, if he wants it, because I think there are certain things I can. I shall start by saying sort of. A great number of people, when I told them I was coming to this service and asked to preach, I did raise their eyebrows and said, "My, that's a difficult job." And I said, "Well, there are certain things that we can be thankful for, and one the return home of our own soldiers with so few casualties, accord of the United Nations," and here I would agree with Archbishop Runcie in saying, although there had been all these mistakes beforehand, you're paralysed in action if because you've made mistakes in the past, you don't do the right thing in the future. That was a good thing, whatever mixed motives there were in doing it about the oil. And three, one cannot but be impressed at the colossal technical skill and things of all those who've worked and got that, the tremendous precision and things there. But with any Thanksgiving service has to ask for forgiveness, and there are certain and there are other things we cannot be entirely happy at having to cause. At having to cause 80,000 deaths there, or the situation that has arisen since, although there, of course, probably it's less English action there than Bush having to urge them all to rise and and throw out this man. I would be rather relieved if the young man. I'll get in touch with him shortly and say, in view of the situation now, are you still going ahead with this? And do you really think the thing is enough over? Because it looked as if it was. And it'd be interesting to see what happens in Glasgow at the beginning of May with the National Thanksgiving Service, which seems to have got into a real mess.
Yes, why do you say that?
Well, the fact that the government, they took such care, luckily, the Falklands to make it ecumenical, all the churches involved. Here they've just got in touch with the minister of Glasgow Cathedral, and he apparently acted entirely on his own, although they're very closely connected together in Scotland. And of course, nearly all the churches there, leaders, churches were against the war, he'll do a very good sermon there. But I'm surprised that John Hapgood. He may have said, "Well, why aren't you getting the moderator of the Church of Scotland to do it? Because that is the established church, as it were, in Scotland. Why have you asked me?" I mean, he was asked in England, of course, because there was no Archbishop of Canterbury at the time. And the other churches are feeling tremendously that they haven't been haven't been asked enough.
Right, that, you know, if there is going to be a service, it should be in Scotland.
It was interesting idea, the major's, with the Scottish regiments up there, and I suppose he felt that it takes the No, I don't know whether I felt it was right or wrong. It took the blast away. It helped Scottish pride, I think, possibly, because they always feel something happens down in the south, don't they? There, and I should think all English top church people were enormously relieved as to having to work out how. And in Scotland, apparently, I mean, well, in England, of course, people don't realise that in a cathedral, the bishop and the archbishops have virtually no power whatsoever. I mean, it's the dean and chapter who totally rule the roost as to what happens. I mean, when I was chaplain to Archbishop Fisher, they were very strict about this at Westminster Abbey. I mean, at the wedding of Margaret and Anthony Armstrong Jones, there was all the business of the processions in and out, and the dean and chapter with all the attendants and everything led the royal party out and the wedding party out. Then, just sort of almost in italics below that, a retiring procession of the visiting primate. That was the Archbishop. and one dean told me that even of the Bishop of London, he always at the door, to make him quite sure he knew his position, sort of said, "I return you, my lord, to your diocese," to show that the abbey was outside his control. Yeah. And they do seem to have made rather a mess of the arrangements. I gather the others of the Church of Scotland are a bit upset. The Episcopal Church of Scotland feel that hasn't been consulted enough. We clergy are very just as human about this and get as grieved.
Well, what do you yourself think the Church's position should be regarding war?
Well, yes. I think again you'll get the divide. Some of the bishops were against it, some were for. I mean, I think again, I take as you find I do in so many things, the Uncle William's position that some people will see this, know that you can't do this, and others, yes. Must. I mean, it's true, of course. If far more had been done about Sudan earlier, I mean, my uncle's point always that if sufficient power, sufficient force is used early enough, it's always much less force. But for 8 years there, we were building up Sudan. Because he was the friend against Iran, who'd been the great friends of the states till they overthrew the Shah, and it's. I think they ought to take a much firmer line about army. Arms sales and things, but of course they always answer there, well, if we don't do it, some other country will, but someone's got to make a start there. I mean, it's weapons of one's own country. I mean, we realised this in a different way when we went to stay with Joan's niece, who some years ago was married to a Frenchman. And to find their delight in the Falklands War that the exocets had been so good. Against. And really worked well. Yeah.
Do you think this Gulf conflict, you know, and the nature of the alliance and the Middle East in particular, has brought out this issue of interfaith? That a lot of them were Muslims.
Yes. Yes, I think, I think my position used to be that Christianity in that sense, about from a worship point of view, was quite unique and different. And I would, and I do still, I think, find it rather difficult about an interfaith service, because as again, always quoting him, as Uncle William used to say, Christianity is the only religion that is indicative. Every other religion is imperative. Every other religion is God outside the world sending prophets and others telling us how we should work. Christianity believes that he came into the world and lived, died, and rose again. And this is absolutely unique quite different. And so he would never take part in a interfaith act of worship, but would work and cooperate with men of goodwill of all faiths. It's getting us to understand more of our religion, and it may be now that one should see that while as being in the job one's in, so naturally think Christianity is has more to it than others, is that one hopes that people will that everyone will see that Christ has the culmination of all truth, but clearly that other religions, as they're groping on, as we're all groping on our way, may have other aspects that should be added to a real Christian religion. I mean, this is true, I think, that, for instance, the Africans' jubilation and dance and other things, the Chinese, where the Chinese church is growing so fast, has other sides of the patience and the quiet and the link and the readiness that things don't happen very fast to it, so that in that side more can happen, I think, there. But I would find it very difficult to. I mean, I can't believe in a jihad, a holy war, that sort of thing. And also, I don't believe that Christ, I mean, they dodged the major issue for the Christian, that they believe that Christ was a great prophet, but was whisked into heaven without suffering. There.
Was your pacifism, and the fact that you were a CO in World War II, was it ever held against you in your life in the ministry?
No, I don't think it has been. Possibly because more to the fore has been that I was in an ambulance unit. I mean, again, say that's the easy way out, that people thought, oh, yes, that's very good, etc. And of course, the Finns very sweetly devised a special medal for us because they realised we were conscientious objectors. I've never worn it, actually. I would love to have worn it at some great army parade service, because one could see all the army people looking, saying, "What's that? What's that?" Never seen that before. And de Gaulle, and we all got the Medaille Coloniale, of course. And first of all in Syria, and then in Libya. And so I can say that I have the MC with bar. Really, in that way. No, I don't think I've had it held against. In fact, when I've had to talk to it, to clergy, I mean, some of them are interested to find that I've had this business of sort of swaying in the middle and wondering with the after the concentration camps were opened.
Do you think doubt is important?
I think doubt is vital, yes. I think St. Thomas is one of my favourite saints. yes, I think it's all a probing and a questioning. To quote William, I do not believe in a creed. I believe in a person. And a creed helps me to articulate and understand a bit my belief in that person. I mean, he, of course, was refused ordination at the start by the Bishop of Oxford because at that time he couldn't believe in the virgin birth. But luckily for the church and the world. He was a don at Magdalen, Oxford, in those days, and archbishops of Canterbury can ordain dons of Oxford colleges, and knew him well, and so they're marvellously tactful and delicate, and letters between the two sort of, I would hate to override you, Bishop, but I do feel this young man has promise, and, and possibly he's expressed his opinions more radically than he would now, and so in the end, Strong says he'd be quite happy to let William be ordained.